All right, open your Bibles, if you would, please, to Acts chapter 26. Acts chapter 26. Obviously, this being our fifth anniversary as a fellowship, my message today will be somewhat different than what I normally bring, and I will try to bring this message in a vein that would be fitting for such an occasion as this anniversary Sunday. First, let me just read you the story that we find in Acts chapter 26 and use that as an illustration and a springboard into my comments today. Acts chapter 26. Then Agrippa said unto Paul, "Thou art permitted to speak for thyself." Then Paul stretched forth the hand and answered for himself, "I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I shall answer for myself this day before thee, touching all the things whereof I am accused of the Jews, especially because I know thee to be expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews. Wherefore I beseech thee to hear me patiently." That's my appeal to you every Sunday. Hear me patiently. "My manner of life from my youth, which was at the first among mine own nation at Jerusalem, know all the Jews, which knew me from the beginning, if they would testify that, after the most straitest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers, under which promise our 12 tribes, instantly serving God day and night, hope to come. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews. Why should it be thought a thing incredible with you that God should raise the dead? I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth, which thing I also did in Jerusalem. And many of the saints did I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests. And when they were put to death, I gave my voice against them. And I punished them oft in every synagogue, and compelled them by torture. I compelled them to blaspheme or to deny Christ. And being exceedingly mad against them, I persecuted them even unto strange cities," meaning cities outside of Israel. Let me just make a note here on verse 11. As Paul is giving his personal testimony, in verse 11, look at the language again that he used. "I punished them off in every synagogue, compelled them to blaspheme, being exceedingly mad against them, persecuted them even unto foreign or strange cities." Albert Barnes writes this about verse 11. And this is just a passing comment as we go through the testimony of Paul. But here's what he writes. He takes the phrase, "and being exceeding mad." Now listen to what Barnes, again, this would be the mid-19th century Bible commentator. "Nothing could more forcibly express his violence against the Christians. He raged like a madman. He was so ignorant that he laid aside all appearance of reason with the fury and violence of a maniac. He endeavored to exterminate them from the earth. Listen carefully. None but a madman will persecute people on account of their religious opinions. None but a madman will persecute people on account of their religious opinions. And all persecutions have been conducted like this, with the violence, the fury, and the ungovernable temper of maniacs. That commentary right there should be put up after we hear the comments of many of our so-called Christian politicians on Fox News. That's an aside. But that was the maniacal passion that Paul had against the church. He's bearing his soul as he tells about his past. Verse 11, and I punished him, read that. Verse 12, whereupon as I went to Damascus, that would be in Syria, with authority and commission from the chief priests. Again, all this was done under the color of law. All of this persecution, all of this murder against the Christians in and around Jerusalem and Judea was done under the color of law. The scribes, the Pharisees, the Jewish Sanhedrin being the ones issuing the lawful legal documents against these Christian folks. Paul, at that time named Saul, was one of the executors of those orders. At midday, O king, I saw in the way a light from heaven, above the brightness of the sun, shining round about me and them which journeyed with me. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking unto me and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks. And I said, who art thou, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus, whom thou persecutest. But rise and stand upon thy feet, for I have appeared unto thee for this purpose, to make thee a minister and a witness both of these things which thou hast seen and of those things in which I will appear unto thee, delivering thee from the people, meaning the Jewish people, and from the Gentiles unto whom now I send thee, meaning I will protect you and defend you from these who are trying and who will try to kill you, to open their eyes and to turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan unto God, that they may be receive forgiveness of sins and inheritance among them which are sanctified by faith that is in me. Whereupon, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient unto the heavenly vision. And that is my text for my remarks to you today. But showed first unto them of Damascus. Isn't that interesting? The first people that heard the words of the former Saul, now Paul the Apostle, were men and women that were not even in Israel. They were in Damascus, Syria. And then Jerusalem. And then throughout the coasts of Judea, and then unto the Gentiles, be the Gentile nations surrounding, that they should repent and turn to God and do works meet for repentance. For these causes, the Jews caught me in the temple and went about to kill me. Having therefore obtained help of God, I continue unto this day. Paul was rehearsing very briefly his life. And when he said the Jews caught him and tried to kill him, that was not just a one-time event. That was a over and over and over and over event. They constantly tried to kill him. And God constantly protected him. And Paul said, I'm alive to stand before you today and tell you about this, because God protected me. Help of God. Witnessing both the small and great, saying none other things than those which the prophets of Moses did say should come, that Christ should suffer, that he should be the first that would rise from the dead, and should show light unto the people of Israel, and to the Gentiles. In verse 19, Paul told King Agrippa, I was not disobedient unto the heavenly vision. This was a turning point in Saul's life. It changed him. It set him on a new course. He risked his life repeatedly as a result. Had God not superintended over his life, supernaturally protecting him, shielding him, giving him friends where he did not even know he had them, touching the hearts of other people to put their lives in jeopardy for the protection of Paul. Some of them even gave their lives to protect Paul. God arranged his life in such a way that now he stands in front of King Agrippa, having been accused of the Jews of crimes worthy of death. And Paul is able to defend himself and to explain himself in the front of this king and all of his court, and at the same time tell his testimony of how God had changed his life, and give to Agrippa the message of the saving gospel of Christ. If you keep reading, you'll hear King Agrippa say to Paul, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. That's a shame, isn't it? A lot of people will go to hell, but almost a Christian. But the powerful testimony of Paul was as such that even King Agrippa felt the convicting pull of the Spirit of God in his heart, and almost trusted Christ for himself. O King, I was not disobedient unto the heavenly vision. A turning point. As I read this chapter, I thought about the turning points of my life. And as we celebrate our fifth anniversary as Liberty Fellowship, I'm going to do something I don't normally do, and that's talk a little bit about your pastor and the things that brought him to this place and the turning points of his life. Turning point number one. As an 18-year-old young man, surrendering my life completely, unreservedly, wholeheartedly to Christ. I had accepted the Lord when I was a little boy at the age of 5, and I believe at that moment I was a saved lad. Raised in a wonderful home. I know there are a lot of people listening to me, including many of you, that did not have happy childhoods. You had perhaps a mother, a father, or both that perhaps were abusive or neglectful. Maybe you were raised in a broken home or maybe a dysfunctional home. And I know that the scars of that are with you all of your life. I understand that completely. I just have to thank God that I was not raised by the father that my sisters were. Because when my sisters were young, our father, theirs and mine, was an alcoholic who drank all the money away. He wasn't abusive when he got drunk. He wasn't mean and hateful and beat his wife and kids. He didn't do that. He just got on a freight train and disappeared for months at a time and was never seen. Take a few paychecks, all the money that should have been spent for food and clothes and shelter for his two little girls and his wife, he just drank away in the hobo jungles throughout America. My two sisters did not know the father that I knew. And that's a shame. And I feel very badly for them. Because the father I knew was like the Paul who had been Saul. He was a dynamic Christian man who never drank a drop of alcoholic beverage from the time that he was converted to Christ about 5 years before I was born. He raised me in a Christian environment, a stable family environment. Well, I grew up in a small Midwestern town, very much like Kalispell, very little crime, good solid community values, family-friendly community. It's just a very good place to grow up. And I grew up in a home where there was love expressed to me by my parents every day. I have nothing but happy memories of my childhood. The only thing that I remember as a kind of a fearful thing was my dad was 45 when I was born. When you're a little tyke and your dad is in his 50s, he might as well be 150. He's old. He's ancient. He's from another era. They didn't have electricity when my dad was a boy. The earth was flat when my dad was a boy. And as a little guy, the only thing that I remember was, you know, I lived with that fear. I knew that any day dad was just going to fall over dead. You know, come on, he's 55 years old. How long can he live? And I grew up with that in the back of my mind, thinking that your dad was just going to, he lived to be 86 years of age, and all I'm saying is it was a good childhood. But when I got into my teen years, the self-will and the rebellion against hypocrisy among Christian people pulled me in a direction that was not good to go. I saw no hypocrisy at home, but I seemed to see nothing but hypocrisy at church. And by the time I was 16 years of age, I had pretty much had it with church and Christians and all of that. So I went my own way. And there's no sense to go into details at that point. But at the age of 18, going into my senior year of high school, God sent a man into my life who was filled with love and compassion and genuineness. That man is still alive today. He is up in his 80s. He's been through more heartache and grief and suffering than I could possibly imagine. If I were to tell you his story of the things that he's gone through, you would think I would be exaggerating. And I wouldn't be. I've never known a man to suffer as much in the ministry, as a father, as a Christian. I don't know anyone. And if he were to walk in this room today, he would still have a smile on his face and a gleam in his eye. He would stand up here and he would bless you all in the name of the Lord. And you would see and you would feel the love in his heart, just as I did as an 18-year-old rebellious, self-willed teenager. The love of that man melted my heart. About two Sundays later, I found myself on my knees in a Carpenters Union Hall building that was converted into a church on Sunday. And I told the Lord then, as that 18-year-old young man, I said, "Lord, from this moment on, I will do anything you want me to do. I'll go anywhere you want me to go, and I'll be anything you want me to be." I meant it with all of my heart. And by the way, I still do. I had no idea at that time what that would lead to. No way of knowing. But that was a turning point in my life. I didn't see a light from heaven like Saul. I didn't hear an audible voice, as did Saul. But there is no doubt, I heard in my heart the voice of God. And I have not been disobedient to the heavenly vision. Turning point number two, a few months after that, I was attending a youth rally at a small church in a little country town in northern Indiana called Winnemac. You have a hard time even finding that town on the map. A little farm community, First Baptist Church, Winnemac, Indiana. The pastor's name was Larsine. Everybody called him Bud Hall. They had a special guest speaker that night. His name was Bill Papadopoulos. Yeah, you got it right. He was a Greek. His wife's name was Jan. He played the trumpet. She played the piano and sang. He called himself the King's Trumpeter. And he would play the trumpet, and his wife would play the piano and sing, and then he would preach. As an evangelist, he would travel all around the country. I have no idea. I've never seen Bill or Jan Papadopoulos, never heard from them since. It was a one-time meeting. I'm so glad that as a teenager I was at that meeting, because it was that night that, after I had already told God I would do whatever he wanted me to do a couple of months earlier, not knowing what that was, now God told me what it was, and he called me to preach the gospel. And I went to that pastor and told him that night God had spoken to my heart and called me to preach his word. Of course, I would say yes, because I already told the Lord I would do whatever he wanted me to do. Bud said, go back to your home church, go tell your folks, go tell Brother Jack Cox, your pastor, and God will take it from there. I did just that. Turning point number two. Turning point number three, of course, was the decision to begin a family. How in the world could I have ever dreamed that God would give my wife and I beautiful, wonderful Christian children, and now grandchildren that God has given to our family? This fellowship is impacted significantly by the combined talents and heart of the family that ministers here. Our country, I believe our nation, will feel the effects for good and for God for generations, because of the children of this family and now grandchildren. I could not be prouder of them as a father. I could not be more thankful to God for his grace and goodness to my wife and I. I think she would say as well as I that we certainly feel it's not anything that we deserve. It is totally and thoroughly God's grace. But that was a turning point. Turning point number four was to leave the school of the Pharisees. Understand, I'm trying to make all this brief. I was not raised in a legalistic home. My dad was not a legalist. He probably wouldn't even know the definition of the term. It was nothing that he ascribed to. It was nothing that he had been taught. And he certainly did not train me in that mindset. But when I went off to Bible college, I found myself not knowing then where I was in the very epicenter of what was at its prime, at its zenith, a legalistic environment. When you are young and impressionable and holding on to every word that you hear from your mentors, you tend to take most everything as gospel. Probably intrinsic to the entire scope of training. But even then, after 2 years of exposure to that, I don't know how to explain this except to say that you folks that have never been in it can't possibly comprehend what I'm talking about. Those of you that have been in it, you know what I'm talking about. Legalism will either, it'll do two things, one of two things to you. It'll either make you a robot or a rebel. There are no other choices. There are no other options. You either become a robot. You lose all ability to think for yourself. Your identity, your security is not in the conviction of truth that you've come to by personal study and prayer, but it's something that is mandated upon you by others, and you become their slave. Or you start thinking for yourself and you become a rebel. Because in those environments, you're not allowed to think for yourself. You're not allowed to believe anything that's not scripted. 2 years of that drove me into a mindset that was totally foreign to me. I became something that I wasn't. And I reacted the only way I could, the only way I knew how. I would never be a man's slave or robot, so I became a rebel. And all you little kids that are listening now, Mom and Dad, you might want to just go ahead and put him to sleep, give him a little nap, just kind of block out. I don't want to cause any undue duress upon your leadership as a mom and dad in your home this afternoon and tomorrow when your kids throw up in your face what I'm about to say. But in that school, every Monday we had chapel. And of course the preacher would get up and preach us, you know, so we'd all fall under conviction. And then we'd go out to the hallway and we'd look at a list that had posted a list of names. It was called the DC list, and DC stands for Discipline Committee, which means you've done something wrong since last Monday. And you got to appear before the board to give an account of yourself. I mean, when you're a kid, you're 20 years old, you're doing all this and you're mesmerized and you're infatuated. I mean, we're talking big. We're talking thousands. You know, we're talking, this is a big, big deal. And, you know, you're walking into the throne room of God. Well, it didn't take very many weeks, and I never even bothered after chapel concluded to even look at the list. I just went and got in line because I knew I was on the list. I didn't have to look. So I was always the first one. They knew me well. I don't know. God protected me. You're supposed to be kicked out of school if you got 100 demerits. Are you kidding me? I had 100 demerits in 3 months. But they didn't kick me out. Ah, there's so many stories I could tell. After 2 years, after my sophomore year, I just had enough. I mean, I knew that I had to be my own man. This was not what God wanted for me. So I left the school of the Pharisees. Doesn't mean that all of them are bad people. Doesn't mean that all of them are ungodly people. There are a lot of good, wonderful people there. But that legalistic, pharisaical philosophy is enslavement to the mind and the heart of man. And I had to get away. And I thank God I did. It was a turning point. Turning point number 5 was when I answered the call to start our first church. It was a very clear revelation from God that that was what I was to do and that was where I was to go. 23 years of age, we had little Sarah at the time, 6-7 months old, and we started our church with 6 people. That would have been myself, my wife, our one child, our daughter Sarah, at about the age of 6 months, my mother-in-law, and one other couple. That was the total membership of our church. And I've often said to preachers when I have the opportunity to talk to them, if you want a challenge, not only will you start a church from scratch with nobody, hardly anybody, but you'll do it with your mother-in-law. But Betty has been a marvelous mother-in-law, and I love you, Betty. And we stayed there for 35 years, knowing God had called us. It was a typical, organized, traditional 501c3 church. I was a typical, well, maybe not, but somewhat, 501c3 pastor. I was schooled in it. I knew the ins and out of it. Rose through the maturation stages of that ministry with all of the open doors and opportunities that that afforded. So, when I talk about the non-501c3 church, and I talk about the unorganized church, and I talk about all the things that you have come to hear me say week by week, you've got to understand that for 35 years, I was in the other camp. I know it backward and forward, inside and out. I know whereas of I speak in these matters. There's nothing you can tell me about those issues that I do not know and have had copious experience with. Turning point number 6 was when I answered the call to patriotism, and that was in 1979. At that point, I didn't know what all that meant. But I knew in my heart God wanted me to do more than just preach to my local congregation on Sunday morning. That as a watchman, as a shepherd, I had a responsibility to my community and to my country. And so in 1979, still very ignorant of a lot of things, not understanding what I know now, of course, it was a very meager, it was an uninformed, even maybe ignorant attempt to engage the culture and society, but it was a conscious, willful commitment that I made to be part of that, what we now call the freedom fight. I began to be involved in virtually every issue that you could think of back in that era. I became the executive director of the Moral Majority in the state of Florida from 1979 to 1988. I traveled all over the country, had the opportunity to meet just about every significant conservative, quote-unquote, senator, congressman, not most, the presidents and vice presidents, governors, the whole wave of the so-called religious right, Christian conservatism. I was in on the ground floor of that. I was in on the ground floor. I rose through the ranks of that movement. You just cannot name a name that I was not familiar with at that time, personally. I was at the big meetings, the rise of Ronald Reagan, the whole era. I was there with it. I don't regret any of that because it was a tremendous teaching tool for me. I learned the things that were right about these issues, and I also learned the things that were wrong. It was an eye-opening experience. And that was a conscientious decision. Turning point number 7 was when I started my radio talk show in 1994. That changed my life. As soon as I sat behind the microphone for the very first time, it was like a light went on. I had the privilege from 1994 to 2002 for the next 8 years to talk with the most notable people in the country. I was, because of the talk show, it grew in such popularity that it became a significant role. Most of the so-called conservative people, when they come through my area, they would look me up. I had people from various levels. I'm trying to say this in a way that's, FBI agents, Secret Service agents. I've had people during all that era that I was in constant contact with. It was the rush of all of that is hard to capsule. Everything that came later was a result of my radio talk show in 1994. Turning point number 8 was almost, if not the most significant turning point next to my commitment to Christ of my entire life. And turning point number 8 was not any position held or venture attempted or notable distinction given or anything like that. It was totally an innate heart decision, but it was a turning point. And turning point number 8 was to abandon my quest for success and to pursue truth, no matter what. When you look at some of these notable personalities, and you wonder, why do they compromise this, and why do they do this, and placate this, and pander this, and, you know, let me tell you, if success is your motivation, you will do whatever you got to do to be successful. That's the bottom line. If you have to pander, you will pander. If you have to placate, appease, compromise, you will do it. Oh, you'll try to be as judicious as you can about it because you don't want to offend some of the people that are supporting you. But you will, because the motivation of your heart is success. I was there. I was there. The open doors were there. The contacts were there. Look at your Rolodex. You don't have Rolodexes anymore. I know. You look at your Rolodex and you go through the names of the people that are in your Rolodex. Pretty heady stuff. You can call in favors. You can talk to powerful people. I'm trying to think what was the event that may have triggered my decision. There was probably three or four things. I'll never forget, I was sitting among the who's who of the religious right at a meeting with President Reagan, Vice President Bush, and other dignitaries. And during the course of this several-day event, we had an opportunity to interact with the media. And I remember the panel being assembled, the men representing virtually the totality of what we would then call the religious right, powerful political bloc. At that time, we're talking the Reagan years, that would have been the most significant political bloc in America, bar none, at that moment. Bar none, it was the most significant political bloc. And questions were asked, and various leaders took the microphone in response, and I'll never forget the one question that was asked. So, fellows, what is it that you really want through all of this effort of yours? You know, you have been tremendously successful in galvanizing voters and, you know, getting the issues you want in front of the people and becoming a significant political force on Capitol Hill and in the White House. What is it you really want? What are you looking for? Pretty good question, wasn't it? And I'll never forget it. I could tell you who said it, but I won't. And he took the answer and he said, here's what we want. All we want is a seat at the table. And I'm sitting down from him just a few chairs. And that answer hit me like a brick. All we want is a seat at the table? Really? Is that what this is all about? And I came to realize that, yes, that is exactly what it was all about. We had the political clout at that time. We could have prevented the appointment of George H.W. Bush as Vice President of the United States of America. There was a huge inner fight going on at that time against Mr. Bush. Those of us that were committed to the principles of constitutional government knew in our heart and in our soul that George H.W. Bush was the antithesis of everything we believed. Everything. He represented the worst of Washington, D.C. And we had the political clout at that time to stop that appointment. There was a strong move at the rank and file level, and to have Mr. Reagan select Jesse Helms as his vice president. We've had no greater anti-communist senator in modern memory than Jesse Helms. But the goal was to have a seat at the table. The goal was not constitutional government. The goal was not liberty. The goal was not freedom. The goal was not what's right for America. Think what could have happened. For all intents and purposes, from the first administration of George H.W. Bush, you only had one, I understand, but from that administration, all the way through the administrations, two of them, of Barack Obama. We're talking George H.W. Bush, one term. We're talking Bill Clinton, two terms. We're talking G.W. Bush, two terms. We're talking Barack Obama, two terms. Nine presidential administrations, if I'm getting that right. 28 years of presidential leadership in this country, and for all intents and purposes, we have only had one presidential administration ever since George H.W. Bush was elected President of these United States of America. Only had one presidential administration. There has not been a dime's worth of difference between the administrations of Clinton and Bush 2 and Obama and Bush 1, that's been one continuous neocon, anti-America, anti-freedom, administration. We've lost the liberties and the values that we held dear as a republic because of this continuous administration that started with George H.W. Bush. Think how American history could have been changed had Mr. Reagan selected Jesse Helms as his vice president instead of George Bush. I know in my heart of hearts, I will go to my grave believing in my heart of hearts that it was the pastors, the members of the religious right, the leaders of the of that religious right Christian coalition, that whole phenomena back in that. We were the ones that gave America this neocon, war crazy, war mad, anti-constitution, anti-liberty, pro-police state. Everything that we're dealing with today was created by the religious right. You can blame all the social democrats, you can blame all the liberals, you can get on that tangent if you want to. I was there. Why was Bush selected? Because the religious right, wanted a seat at the table. And they would do anything to get it. And once they got it, they would do anything to keep it. And we've been dealing with the results of that for the last almost 3 decades. Somewhere in the middle of all of that, I got alone with my heart and with my Creator and my conscience. And I said to myself, and I committed to God, from this day forward, the goal of my life is not success. It is truth. If I must go without, I will go without. If people don't like what I'm going to say and leave and don't give their offerings to sustain my work, so be it. I will never again placate or pander the message of truth for anyone. You clap, but you don't know what you're clapping for. You have no idea what that decision cost me and my family. No idea. But I can tell you to this very second, that is still my quest. I will follow truth wherever it leads me, and I will proclaim truth, whatever it may be. That was a turning point. I lost my radio talk show due to lack of support. Within 2 years, I lost my radio talk show. people that used to call me the rising star of Republican conservatism now deem me to be an enemy. The phone calls dried up. The invitations dried up. The friendships dried up. It all just evaporated. At about that same time, or shortly thereafter, turning point number 9 occurred. I began writing my syndicated column. The syndicated column became much more than anything the radio talk show had ever been. And as in the spoken part of my work, so in the written part of my work, I'm going to write what I think is true. You don't know how many times I've written a column, and then I'll go in and say to my wife after I've written it, well, let's see how long we can keep the lights on after this one goes out. I never know what the reaction is going to be. And I never even think about it. I'm really not trying, this is not a pat me on the back, if that's what you're getting. That's not what this is. But I'm telling you the reason that we don't have more preachers standing up and speaking the truth. The reason we don't have more columnists. The reason we don't have more radio talk show hosts. The reason we don't have more of these talking heads on television or in the major newspapers. The reason that they're not willing to address these salient issues with conviction and with power and authority is because in their heart, the bottom line is success. It's a job. I got to do it. You know, how many? Oh, I know. I don't want to do this. Mr. Police Officer says, I don't want to do this. It's just my job. Mr. Federal Agent says, I don't want to do this. It's just my job. Some of you out there in the audience, what you do, what you compromise, and what you give away, what you surrender. Well, it's just my job. We all get that. That's the standard response from everybody. It's just my job. So we don't expect people to speak truth, pursue truth, follow truth wherever it leads, be willing to stand no matter what the consequences, because we all get that. I got to pay my bills. I got kids to feed. I got a house payment. I got to pay the light bill. Really? I thought as Christians we only had one job to do. Just one job. Do the will of God in the fear of God. That's the only job we've got to do. Let God take care of the result. You know, we say all the time, God is our source, you know, God is our sustenance. We don't believe that. You don't believe that if in your heart your motive is success. Let God determine your success. Let God determine the consequences. That was a major turning point. So now that I've done that, that's why, you know, when some of you think I'm bullheaded and hard to get along with, and mean and nasty and rotten and terrible, awful. Because I've already been there. I've already been. What I'm gonna? You're gonna ask me to pander now? You're gonna ask me to compromise now? You're gonna ask me to do that now? Really? Now? If I was gonna do that, I'd have done that back yonder. And if I had done that, I wouldn't be here. There wouldn't be a Liberty Fellowship. The work I've done over the last many, many years would never have happened. I probably would have been on Easy Street as far as material success is concerned. I probably would have enjoyed that notoriety and all that stuff that I was surrounded with if success was the motivation. Maybe retired by now on a nice pension and so now you're going to ask me to not be so dogmatic? Really? Now you're going to say, well, you need to just see it a little bit differently. Been there, done that. Smoked the cigar, bought the t-shirt. No, thank you. Turning point. Truth is my quest. Success be damned. Turning point number 9. Excuse me, turning point number 10. The decision to run for president on the Constitution Party ticket after Ron Paul dropped out of the race. That's not something I ever desired. It's not something they ever sought. I was campaigning for Ron vigorously. I did everything I could for him. I campaigned in several states for him. I wrote columns on his behalf. I did everything I could as one person could do to help him. As far as I can remember, he's the only presidential candidate I've ever given any money to. And the way things are shaping up, probably the only one I ever will. After he dropped out, many of his supporters, and Ron and I had become friends, they approached me and said, somebody has got to take the Liberty message into the general election. McCain surely isn't going to do it. You got to do this. I hesitated, was reluctant, finally decided to do it. I had to run a primary race against Ambassador Alan Keyes in order to obtain the nomination, which I did and I won. And I became that nominee. And while that was one of the most grueling, excruciating, painful 6 months of my life, the stress it put on our family, the rigors of it, the unbelievable trauma that it caused, at the end was worth it. We were able to touch the hearts of millions of people that otherwise would never have known about us. We were able to communicate a message in a way that has proven itself to be productive in the hearts and lives of many people ever since. In fact, I can say that now, here we are, these many years later, going back from 2008, I really think that we are further ahead now than we were then. And that the campaign we ran then is still clipping coupons in the freedom fight even today. So I'm glad I did it, but it was a, don't ever ask me to do it again. And then, of course, turning point number 11 is the move to Montana and planting Liberty Fellowship. That was monumental, to say the least. At that point, everything about the decision was vague. Not the decision wasn't clear. That was a clear decision. But knowing what we know now and what God has given us here as a fellowship and the platform he's given us, the work he's given us, we couldn't foresee all of that. And then when you add the fact that, you know, you're leaving something that you've, the only thing you've known your entire adult life as far as professionally is concerned, 35 years, our children born and raised there, everything we had known as adults was there, of supposed friends of a lifetime were there, financial security was there. Everything that we knew was there. So whenever the time came that we knew we were going to leave, even though it was a clear decision based upon God's will and seeing it clearly, there was still an ambiguity about it all that we could not foresee or envision. I've never done this before. Wasn't trained for this, except God's experiences trained me for this. But, so we came, and then as soon as we made the decision, all hell broke loose. And the pain of that we will carry with us for the rest of our lives. And through that, this whole 501c3 nonprofit organization status, the whole picture became crystal clear. Before that, it was a cloud. In my gut, I knew it wasn't, you know, the best. I've been quoted as saying, and I've said it all over the country back when I was running in 2008 and so forth. I said, look, the 501c3 tax exempt status is a tree that pastors use to hide behind. And I said, cut down the tree and the pastor will go find another tree to hide behind, because the problem is not the tree, the problem is the cowardice of the man that hides behind it. And that's a true statement. I still believe that. But the problem is, that tree is a giant redwood. You don't just cut it down. It's more than something to hide behind. It's an entire system. it may help to create the cowardice, but by its very nature, it is an evil, enslaving system that has choked the church of the Lord Jesus Christ almost to death. All of that, I had to go through what we went through in order to see that. Otherwise, I wouldn't have ever seen it. But now I see it. And it's helped to clarify our work and our message and everything that we're doing. I understand the people that don't see it, because I didn't see it either. If you're keeping track, that's 11 turning points. And if you believe in numerology, the number 11 means nothing. So that means maybe there's one more turning point ahead, because 12 is perfection, you know. I don't know. Maybe that turning point's when I go to heaven. I don't know. But just 11. I'm waiting now, oh man, what's that 12th one? Can I be, well, I know it's a silly question. Sorry, can I be honest? I'm going to be honest. No, don't be honest with us. I don't regret a single turning point. And I can say, on this 5th anniversary of our 11th turning point, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. And with God's... and with God's grace, I will not be disobedient to the heavenly vision. Let's all stand for prayer.